From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet British actress Juliet Stevenson. You can see her this Sunday night on Masterpiece Theatre, starring in a BBC production of A Doll's House. She also starred in the film Truly Madly Deeply. Also today, a talk about writing, Zionism, the Holocaust, and peace with one of Israel's most prominent writers, A.B. Yehoshua. His latest novel is Mr. Manny, about six generations of a Jewish family. Rock critic Ken Tucker tells us about a band that lives up to its name, Chic. And Maureen Corrigan recommends a book for the liberated woman who says, "But I'm not a feminist." That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Russian atomic energy officials say there's no danger to the public from radioactive gas that leaked from a nuclear reactor near St. Petersburg today. The gas came from a nuclear reactor like that at Chernobyl, the site of the world's worst nuclear accident in 1986. Swedish experts who visited the plant near St. Petersburg last year had urged that it be closed immediately because of safety concerns. Russian officials described today's leak as a second-class accident, one of the lowest levels of danger. Connecticut voters will decide the first head-to-head matchup between Bill Clinton and Jerry Brown today, but the wild card could be Paul Tsongas, who dropped out of the race last Thursday. Clinton was hoping for a win heading into the New York primary, but the combination of low turnout and some voters supporting Tsongas despite his exit from the race could help Clinton's challenger, Jerry Brown. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Although Tsongas withdrew from the race, there are a number of diehard supporters who say they still voted for him today at the Connecticut polls. That, combined with a low turnout, could magnify a competitive showing by Jerry Brown. Clinton has won 13 states compared to Brown's 3, and Clinton has a 7-1 lead over Brown among nominating delegates. But the former California governor could slow Clinton's momentum down. His campaign would like to shake Brown and concentrate on defeating President Bush in the fall. Clinton campaigned heavily in Connecticut over the last few days. He stressed his support for the Seawolf submarine, a defense budget item slated to be cut that would mean the loss of 17,000 jobs in Connecticut. The Republican race is practically non-existent. Challenger Patrick Buchanan has no campaign in Connecticut, and aside from satellite interviews, President Bush has all but ignored the state. I'm Elizabeth Arnold, reporting.
In a letter to Congress released today, Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney strongly opposed a congressional plan to reorganize U.S. intelligence services. He said the plan was so severely flawed he'd have to recommend a presidential veto if it passes. NPR's Neil Conan reports.
Pentagon spokesman Pete Williams said today that Secretary Cheney feels the proposal would usurp the defense secretary's control of military intelligence, and by combining all intelligence analysis into one agency, the legislation would stifle differing viewpoints. David Boren, the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, said he was disappointed by Cheney's response, but that the end of the Cold War makes structural changes inevitable.
Well, there'll be a lot of jockeying to preserve bureaucratic positions. There'll be turf protection, and I think that's what we see going on here in the Defense Department now. I think when all is said and done, we'll succeed in getting quite a bit accomplished.
The reorganization would greatly reduce the Defense Secretary's role by placing all intelligence agencies in a single service under one director. This is Neil Conan in Washington.
The Dow Industrial Average lost 11 points today. This is NPR. President Bush said today that he'll soon offer some proposals for reforming Congress, a system he said has gone out of control. The attack on Congress came today during a speech to a national group of wholesale grocers. The president also defended his veto of Congress's latest tax bill, saying it would raise taxes by $100 billion. New Hampshire Senator Warren Rudman says he's stepping down after two terms. Sam Fleming of member station WBUR reports.
Rudman is the fifth U.S. senator to call it quits this year, but his was not a case of waning popularity. Rudman's straight-talking, nonpartisan ways won him admirers on both sides of the political aisle, and he was by far the state's most popular politician back home in New Hampshire. Rudman says he's leaving with a huge sense of frustration over a budget deficit which continues to spiral out of control.
This is happening now. This is today. And it is serious.
Rudman co-authored the Graham-Rudman-Hollings deficit reduction law, which he claims worked until entitlements were removed from the equation. New Hampshire's incumbent governor, Judd Gregg, also a Republican, will announce by the end of the week whether he'll run for Rudman's seat. For National Public Radio, I'm Sam Fleming.
The Arkansas chapter of Common Cause charged today that Governor Bill Clinton is giving the impression of being too cozy with rich friends and corporations by accepting free plane rides. State financial disclosure records show that Clinton and his wife Hillary took 136 free airplane rides during the past 2 years. Corporations paid for about 60 of those flights, and Democratic Party organizations paid for about 23. The rest were paid for by private citizens or groups. Clinton said that there was nothing wrong with accepting the trips because he disclosed them. The Washington Post reported Sunday that Clinton accepted 9 trips on planes owned by Tyson Food, a poultry company that's accused of polluting waterways with chicken and cattle waste. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This Sunday night, Masterpiece Theater will present a BBC production of A Doll's House, Ibsen's proto-feminist drama. My guest Juliet Stevenson stars as Nora. Americans haven't seen much of Stevenson yet, but I think most of us who saw her in the film Truly, Madly, Deeply were hoping to see her again soon. The New Yorker film critic Terence Rafferty called her performance remarkable. In England, Juliet Stevenson is best known for her performances with the Royal Shakespeare Company. She also starred in the original British production of Les Liaisons Dangereuses and is now starring in the British production of Death and the Maiden. Here she is with actor Trevor Eve in a scene from the conclusion of A Doll's House when Nora has her awakening.
When I lived at home with Papa, he used to tell me what he thought about everything, and so I thought the same. Or if I didn't, I used to hide it, because he wouldn't have liked it. He called me his doll child, and he used to play with me the way I played with my dolls. And then I came to live in your house.
What a way to talk about our marriage.
What I mean is that I passed from Papa's hands and into yours. You arranged everything according to your taste, and so it became my taste too. Or I pretended it did, I don't really know which. Well, both, I think. First one, and then the other. Looking at it now, I think I have lived here like a pauper. From hand to mouth. I've lived by performing tricks for you, Torvald, because that's the way you wanted it. You and Papa have done me a great wrong. It's because of both of you that I've made nothing of my life.
How unreasonable and ungrateful can you be? I mean, haven't you been happy here?
No. I've never been that. I thought I was.
Not,
but I never really have been.
Not happy?
No. Just cheerful. And you've always been so kind to me, Torvald. But our home has never been more than a doll's house. I've been your doll wife here, just as I was Papa's doll child at home. And the children have been my dolls in their turn. I thought it was fun when you played with me, just as they thought it was fun when I played with them. That's been our marriage, Torvald.
Is there a part of A Doll's House that you find most personally affecting?
I suppose one of the things that I've felt most... is kind of most moving about Nora in a way is that she thinks she's happy, but she never has been. I mean, she's incredibly energetic, full of optimism and buoyancy and positive thinking, you know, for most of the play. Increasingly, obviously, under duress as events take place and she's under greater and greater pressure. But the tragedy, in a way, is that she has constructed her entire life up to that point upon a lie, you know, and I think that's a way in which, I mean, that says a lot about many marriages, I think, that actually there's a level at which each partner in the marriage colludes with a way of life or a conviction about the other person, which is not really who they are. And the tragedy the Doll's House is not that she leaves or anything like that, but I think that she, you know, at the very end, she discovers that everything that she pinned her hopes on, every belief that she had about him and what they could be for each other, was completely misconceived.
A Doll's House is... One of the things that makes A Doll's House exceptional is that it's a play that has a kind of feminist understanding, even though it's from before a feminist period. But you've done a lot of classic drama.
over the years, and most of the now classics were written by men long before feminism, so there's not just a shortage of good roles. But what are the roles like? Do you know what I mean? Do you find enough roles that you really feel comfortable playing?
Well, that's the struggle. That's a challenge to find those roles. I mean, I've had a very lucky time recently because I've been doing a wonderful play here in London, you know, that's just opened on Broadway, Death and the Maiden. And that's a phenomenal role because it's a character who the writer allows to go in every conceivable direction, however unacceptable. It's very difficult to find roles where you can be really unacceptable. You know, very often women's roles are those of women who are somebody's girlfriend or wife or lover or daughter, who you're squeezed into a shape which feels lesser than your own size. And I'm not talking about me, I'm just talking about most women, you know. So it's wonderful. Recently, I feel I've had a real sort of run of luck because I've been able to play women who you can take in many different directions, you know, with whom you have a lot of rope, as it were, as an actress. And the great, great thing about Ibsen is that he conceived of women and wrote for them in a way in which you have enormous range and scope to play with. And, I mean, he did that probably better than many people have done since.
The first time I saw you in a performance, I'll confess, was just a couple of months ago in a screening of Truly Madly Deeply. And you played a woman whose husband recently died, and you miss him so much that you're unable to go on with life. He comes back as a ghost, moves into the house, and becomes something of a pain in the neck. And the movie's both very moving and very funny. There's a scene early on in the film in which you're in your psychiatrist's office explaining how much you miss your dead husband, and you're crying. And I was so moved by that scene, I thought it was one of the most realistic crying scenes I'd ever seen in a film. And I'd love to hear you talk about how, what you did in that scene.
I don't really remember. I think acting in a way is like, you know, you have to perform sort of daylight raids on your own life, you know. I think there are many different kinds of actor and people work in very different ways, but I suppose I've always felt it's sort of what I do with who I am, you know, through the skin of somebody else, you know. I wouldn't want to tell my own story, but I like telling other people's stories. But the raw material, the tools of the trade, as it were, are you and your makeup, as it were, and your experience and stuff. And so there are times when you've got to do something which is a bit challenging or difficult like that, when you really just have to kind of dig a hole for yourself, metaphorically, and slide down into it and stay there, you know. And so it's I don't enjoy those things very much. But I was very lucky. I had the most wonderful team, and that's, I mean, 50% of it, because you can be acting your socks off, of course, but if they don't get it right, you know, if the technical team don't get it right, you're stumped. And I had a wonderful director, you know, Anthony Minghella, and a wonderful cameraman and crew and so on, who were really sympathetic and very sort of understanding about the actor's requirements in the film, and really did everything they could to get it in the can when it was at its best or freshest or whatever, to minimise the number of retakes and for difficult stuff. And so I was very blessed in that way, which was 50% of it, you know.
Now, in England, you've been playing in a production of Death and the Maiden, which is a play by Chilean writer Ariel Dorfman about a woman who was tortured in a Latin American country, then finds the man she believes was the torturer and wants to punish him. The show recently opened on Broadway in a production directed by Mike Nichols, starring Glenn Close, Richard Dreyfuss, and Gene Hackman. Now, in America, there were protests by Latino actors that whites were being chosen for Latino roles, and I was wondering if there's any similar sentiments in England.
No, there hasn't been anything like that at all, but then we don't really have a Latino contingent, really, in the acting profession at all, to speak of. I mean, there's only a tiny handful of Latin American actors here. But the issues never really come up. I mean, I think it was different if we were doing a play, you know, set in the West Indies or set in part of India or Pakistan, because we have large West Indian and Asian population here, but we don't have a big Latin American population here, and certainly very, very few members of Equity are. So that hasn't arisen. No.
But also,
I think because we're English, I don't think, I mean, clearly we're not anything like Latin Americans, and although we've made some concessions to it, because Ariel Dorfman's always insisted that the play is not set in Chile, nor is it about Chile, but it should be set anywhere in the world, China, South Africa, you know, it has resonance for so many places, The whole issue of who should be doing it or whatever has never really arisen.
Did you originate the role? Was it the first production?
Yeah. Yeah.
Were you asked to be in the Broadway production?
Yes.
And what happened?
American Equity wouldn't allow it, wouldn't let me through.
Oh, because they wanted the role to go to an American actor.
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
Things are a bit sort of, well, I was disappointed at the time, of course, personally. And I rather regret, I mean, I think it happened in the wake of the whole business with Jonathan Pryce and Miss Saigon on Broadway and the fact that American Equity had stopped him coming as well and then that Cameron McIntosh, you know, pulled the show out, which had a multi-million dollar advance, so they stood to lose a massive amount of money, so they... Equity then climbed down, and Jonathan Pryce did do the show, of course, and I think that was probably publicly very difficult for Equity to deal with because it was sort of a bit humiliating. And I think I was probably the first Brit to come along after that, you know, and so no doubt they thought, well, this time we're really gonna stick to our guns. But I was disappointed, I was, for a few days when it happened, because the level at which the two unions argue with each other about these things is incredibly banal and very pedantic. And I, in an ideal world, I think the arts are not about that. I mean, I hate the idea of stopping in one musician playing in another. The arts are supposed to cross-fertilise. I spent 6 months with John Malkovich here in the West End last year, year before.
Oh, doing Burn This.
And doing Burn This, and there were four in the cast, and him and another American actor came over. And it never occurred to me they shouldn't be there, and I loved working with them because I learned a lot. I had to throw a lot of my own rules away. I had to negotiate how to work with people from a very different tradition. And I learned, and maybe I hope they learned something too from working with us. And that's very rich, you know, because then you grow and you... That's the way the arts have always worked, you know. Music changes and develops as it crosses cultures and is influenced by other indigenous musicians, and art the same, and... So on a wider level, I really regret the very sort of chauvinistic, self-protective instincts of both English and American Equity. I understand, of course, that there's a recession in both our countries, and so, you know, they're going to be more protective. But in the end, it's I'm not sure who it does protect. I honestly think that if you tried an experiment and opened the doors tomorrow, you know, between America and England, in terms of actors being able to work in each other's countries, I don't think anybody would suffer. I think they'd only gain from it, really.
You know, it seems that Mike Nichols ended up taking a completely different direction afterwards. And what I mean by that is that all of the three actors are very well-known movie stars, Gene Hackman, Richard Dreyfuss, Glenn Close, which isn't to take away. I don't mean to say that they're not capable of performing well on stage, but they're names that are very well-known to just about all American moviegoers, whereas you are not as yet that well-known in America. I mean, it seems to be part of a trend where more and more American theater is going toward big name stars.
Yes. Well, maybe it's a facet of times being tough or something. I mean, it sounds to me, I don't know much about this, but it does sound that the whole business of mounting a Broadway show is now so incredibly risky and so incredibly expensive. I mean, when I tell you that the set for the Broadway production, I think, cost, a phenomenal amount of money, more money than... it takes to mount six productions at the Royal Court here, infinitely more. I mean, the scale of expenditure is so vast now, it seems, in terms of production values and so on, that presumably they can take fewer risks, so they try and put in, I suppose, people who are going to be guaranteed to put a lot of bums on a lot of seats, which is, I think it's fine. I mean, it's one way, you know, it's one aspect of theatre, but I think it's something to be a little vigilant about, because... people going to the theatre to see very famous people perform does have an influence on the relationship they have to the evening.
What do you mean?
You know. Well, in the end, a play is a collective, collaborative act. The putting on of a play is a collaborative activity, and the focus of everybody's attention should be the play. You know, you can be as virtuosic as you like, but I think you have to harness yourself to the event of doing this play if you believe in it. And I think if people are coming along simply because they want to see movie stars in the flesh, then that's a different kind of audience, you know, and it can affect the power of the evening. It can undermine the power of the play, I think, if you... I don't know what's happened. I'm certainly not assuming that this has happened with the current Broadway production of Death and the Maiden. I'm sure it hasn't, because those are three very fine actors we're talking about. Really wonderful actors.
Yeah, yeah.
You know. They're real actors. I mean, I think it just gets a bit dodgy when you have people who are film stars but not good actors, you know. Mm-hmm. Because then obviously at some level the play is not served as well, perhaps.
If you're just joining us, my guest is British actress Juliet Stevenson, who stars this Sunday night in a Masterpiece Theatre production of A Doll's House. It's actually a BBC production, but you can see it on PBS on Masterpiece Theatre. It's this Sunday at 9. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Actress Juliet Stevenson is my guest. You know, one of the differences, it seems to me, between England and America now for actresses is I think that American movies are just much more vigilant at weeding out people who don't conform to what perfect looking is considered to be for the moment. As a matter of fact, even perfect looking actresses have to get plastic surgery now to make themselves slightly more perfect. But that doesn't seem to be happening, at least certainly not to the same extent in England. What do you think?
I think that's true, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, Hollywood's imperatives in terms of what people have to look like are have always been pretty limited, haven't they, in terms of, you know, there's one rule for guys, certainly, and there's another rule for women.
I mean, yeah, yeah.
If you look at Richard Dreyfuss and Gene Hackman, for example, you know, with great respect, they're not kind of traditionally very beautiful-looking people, but they've got wonderful faces.
Right.
I think it's an area where it's much easier for a man, if he's a very good actor, to sustain a career as a film actor as well, even though he may not look like a male model, whereas it is harder for women. But, and obviously that has some truth here too, but not anything like the same extent. But then our business isn't dominated by a large film industry. God knows.
Right. you know what I find? I really don't mind. I mean, I enjoy a glamorous actress in a glamorous role. What bugs me is a glamorous actress in a role of a plain person, and somehow we're supposed to be convinced that this person is plain and that a kind of regular human being looking actress wouldn't be good enough to play the plain person. You know, they have to be glamorous to play her.
Mm. Call me old-fashioned. I think you should look like the character you're playing. You know?
Right.
I mean, that's the sort of center of my preoccupation is how to look like the person that I'm playing.
Right, right. And look glamorous when that's appropriate, and look more plain when
and
that's
not
appropriate.
And not if it's not.
Yeah, Are you interested in making American movies? And do you see a place for yourself in American films as an English actress?
I never have done. I mean, Truly Madly Deeply had a very warm response from the film industry in LA, which was lovely, and I've been out there about 4 times in the last year or so for various reasons. And so a few doors have opened up, as they say, but I don't know. It would be very nice if it happened, but I certainly wouldn't move out there or put a lot of store by it happening because I'd love to do some more filming, and we have such a sort of embattled film industry here, and there's so few movies made here that it is very difficult to keep filming here, as it were, because there's so little going on. So I'd welcome any opportunities that came from America, you know, but it would depend what it was. I mean, the thing that's always guided me is what interests me. What is the interesting material? That's how I make choices about work. So if in the hypothetical event of something coming from America, if it wasn't something which I felt I could connect with, then I wouldn't really want to do it. Do you know what I mean? It's not for the sake of it.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't be for the sake of it that I did it. But it's not very likely anyway, I don't think. So this is hypothesis. But, I mean, I have been, there was sort of quite a lot of pressure last year to go out there and sit around a bit and wait for things to happen and, you know, strike while the iron was hot and all that. But this play came up and I just couldn't resist doing it because it's a wonderful play. Wonderful role. And that's really the way I've always done things. I wouldn't want to turn something down that I felt passionate about in order to go and hang around waiting for something nebulous, as it were. But I would be very happy if something came through that I really wanted to do. be great.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Pleasure.
Juliet Stevenson stars in Henrik Ibsen's A Doll's House this Sunday night on Public TV's Masterpiece Theater. She spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in London.
One, two, three.
If you were alive and cognizant in 1978, you must have heard this song. It was everywhere. Le Freak by the band Chic, as in Trey Chic. Led by guitarist Nile Rodgers and bassist Bernard Edwards, Chic was one of the most popular disco acts in the late 70s and early 80s. Chic has just released their first album since 1983, Chicism. Rock critic Ken Tucker says they've updated their sound.
Chic was the best act of the disco era because it stood in opposition to the cliches of that era. Where most disco songs sprawled endlessly, aimlessly, Chic made music that was tight and succinct. Where most disco sentiments were silly or dumb, Chic's message was shrewd and ironic. When they called their 1980 album Real People, it amounted to a manifesto, an assertion that the people behind this music weren't robots or would-be superstars, they were craftsmen, real people. The title of this new collection is equally portentous, Chicism, an assertion that these compositions transcend dance music to form a genre of their own. There's more to us than meets the eye, Chic sings in that song. Break it down and we'll show you why. Well, here's why. Bernard Edwards' bass offers a rumbling rhythm that provides a deep cushion for Nile Rodgers' quick, meticulously choppy guitar riffs. Edwards and Rodgers are Chic. The vocalists, drummers, and keyboardists are all hired hands, studio musicians. But they cohere as a group, and especially on this great cut, My Love's For Real, Edwards and Rodgers give the singers, Jen Thomas and Silver Logan Sharp, a terrific R&B vocal showcase. I've always loved the fierce tension in Chic's music, the way the icy elegance of the melodies and Chic's demeanor contrasts with the urgency of the rhythms. Their best songs are all implicitly about the frosty reserve that people use to disguise strong emotions, about suppressed passions that find release in music. Chic always rejected the hedonism of disco in favor of a pop realism. When the singers say on this album, "Forget your problems, groove will solve them," Edwards and Rodgers surround that sentiment with surging music that lets you know they think that's a false hope. Chic's sense of escapism remains tinged with an enduring melancholy, which is what makes their 1992 comeback a deeper pleasure than could ever have been expected.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet one of Israel's most acclaimed novelists, A.B. Yehoshua. His family has lived in Israel for six generations. His new novel, Mr. Manny, spans six generations of one Jewish family's history. And commentator Maureen Corrigan makes her best case for feminism. She reviews Nan Robertson's The Girls in the Balcony. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In New York City, UN diplomats are awaiting word from Libya on when and how it will surrender two suspects in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. Meanwhile, the State Department is indicating skepticism over Libya's promise to release the two men. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Libya's UN ambassador told reporters yesterday his government was willing to comply with Security Council demands and release the suspects to the Arab League. Other UN officials said the League would then hand the men over to the United States or Britain for trial. But State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler today suggested that the offer falls short of UN demands. She said the offer has to be spelled out in writing, and she noted that Libya has to agree to other UN conditions as well, by, for instance, renouncing terrorism. Tutwiler suggested that yesterday's offer from Libya was little more than an attempt to buy time, just as the UN Security Council is considering imposing economic sanctions on Libya. Meanwhile, a delegation of Arab League officials was in Tripoli today to try to clarify yesterday's offer. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
Voters are going to the polls today in Connecticut in a Democratic primary election featuring Bill Clinton and Jerry Brown. Paul Tsongas is still on the Connecticut ballot, even though he dropped out of the race last week. Clinton is concerned that a low turnout could enhance Brown's showing in a race that comes 2 weeks before a big contest next door in New York State. Television network exit polls indicate a large protest vote today. President Bush is expected to win easily on the Republican side. At stake are 53 delegates to the Democratic National Convention and 35 GOP delegates. The Bush administration has announced it is establishing diplomatic relations with the former Soviet republic, Georgia. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Georgia was first recognized by the U.S. on December 25th, but it's the last former Soviet republic to win full diplomatic relations. Today, White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater cited Georgia's movement towards restoring civilian rule, beginning a dialogue on national reconciliation, and committing itself to parliamentary elections. At the State Department, spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler cited the role of Edward Shevardnadze as the head of Georgia's State Council. Shevardnadze is a former Soviet foreign minister who has close ties with the U.S. Secretary of State James Baker. The move to establish diplomatic relations with Georgia comes as the Bush administration is considering new legislation to provide aid to the former Soviet republics. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater today said the administration is studying ways to help stabilize the ruble, but he said no conclusions have been reached. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 11 points to close at 3,260.96. This is NPR News. Republican Senator Warren Rudman has announced that he will not seek re-election. Speaking today at the State House in New Hampshire, Rudman said that he was frustrated by the inability of Congress to cut the nation's huge deficit. For more than a year, there has been speculation that Rudman might not seek a third term. He said that by the year 2000, the nation's deficit will be so large that the U.S. will be dependent on foreign governments for loans to keep afloat. Recent clashes in southeastern Turkey between Kurdish nationalist and Turkish military forces have touched off widespread protest in Germany, which is home to the largest community of ethnic Kurds in Western Europe. Deidre Berger reports.
In Wiesbaden, four people were injured when a Turkish bank was destroyed in a firebomb attack. Police suspect Kurdish extremists were responsible, as well as for attacks on Turkish banks and travel agencies in Cologne and Darmstadt. According to the Turkish government, more than 55 people have died the past 3 days in southeastern Turkey. There have been conflicting reports that the military fired into crowds demonstrating for Kurdish independence. In Germany, hundreds of Kurdish nationalists briefly occupied the offices of four major television stations to call attention to the situation. A group of German politicians and lawyers who are currently in southeastern Turkey to investigate the unrest were released today after being temporarily detained in their hotels. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Cologne.
Officials in Amman, Jordan, say that more than 20 people were injured early today and one person was killed in a hotel fire. Officials say that some guests at the downtown hotel were stranded on the upper floors of the building for more than 2 hours until the blaze could be contained. According to witnesses, the fire may have been caused by an electrical problem. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved down against other major foreign currencies. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. My guest, A.B. Yehoshua, is one of Israel's most prominent authors. Like most of that country's best-known writers, his subject is often the issues that unite and divide Israel. Yehoshua is a fifth-generation Israeli. His new novel, Mr. Manny, is about six generations of one Israeli family. Reviewing the book in the New York Times, Herbert Mitgang wrote, "This is a universal story that sums up the modern Jewish experience in adversity and, by extension, the fate of other wanderers seeking safe havens. It is a literary tour de force." I asked Yehoshua about the structure of the novel. It begins in the 1980s during the war in Lebanon, then goes backwards in time to the middle of the 19th century.
This is not an historical novel in the simple sense. It's not the accumulation of time, but the digging back in time, meaning that the problems are coming in the present, and in order to understand the present, you are going back in time. Meaning it's not for just a pleasure or nostalgia or escape from the present, but on the contrary, the point of departure is present. And then you are going backwards in order to understand present.
What were the problems of today that you feel you were trying to work through in the novel?
I think that the problems were in many layers, because the novel is touching ideological layer, political layer, and also, of course, psychological and personal layer. So all is mingled together. But I would say that if the starting point is the war in Lebanon, in 1982, not as a real fact in the novel, it is just the background. The war in Lebanon as such was for me a kind of a new stage and break in my history, in the history of me as a Zionist Israeli, and the breaking of some sacred values, that we will, by our own initiative, will start a war and go to Beirut through villages, through civilians, in order to have such a crazy plan to get rid of the Palestinian or to do peace with the Christians, things like that. For me, as an Israeli that lives all his time by knowing that war is the most evil thing, that we are hating war, that we don't war, that we had enough deaths behind us, this was for me a new stage and breaking some of the sacred laws that existed in the Israeli society.
So how did the war in Lebanon change your sense of what you needed to do as an Israeli?
No, I wanted to understand from which sources these conceptions are coming. I wanted to check again the ideology, the past of my people, in order to understand what is this new element that were exposed in the political life that I did not realize that it is existing in me.
The kind of obvious answer people would give is for Israel, the Holocaust and other oppression suffered by the Jews over the centuries. What did you come up with?
Yes, there will be, of course, many, many answers. But what I wanted is to go backwards and to test the history of the Jewish people during the last 200 years in some of its crossroads, in order to examine what were the decision, what were the ideological decision, if there was any other option, any other alternative. And this is the reason why I was getting backwards. It means I did not understand, and I, you know, as a writer, you are going deep, deep in the soul of your nation. This is one of our, I would say, adventures, that we are going beyond the news, beyond the political commentaries. We are trying to do a psychoanalysis to the soul of the nation. And as you are doing in psychoanalysis, you are going to the childhood or to some traumas that are in the end, in the beginning of the life. This was also the technique of my novel.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Israeli novelist A.B. Yehoshua, who is also active in the Israeli peace movement. He has a new novel called Mr. Mani. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Israeli novelist A.B. Yehoshua is my guest. What brought your family to Israel?
They were brought to Israel. They came from Salonika. Some was coming from Prague. Just naturally, not because anti-Semitism, not because someone chased them. They were coming before Zionism. I want to stress this point because their coming was a kind of a positive one, not from negative reasons, not because they were unhappy, just because they knew Eretz Israel is their home, and this is the place in which they ought to live, and they moved from one part of the Ottoman Empire to another part in the most natural way. This is the reason why I stress my belonging to the country. It wasn't done under any condition that this will be a just society, that this will be a redemption for the Jews, just returning home in the most simple sense of this term.
Do you think that the Holocaust changed the politics and the mood, the whole sense of life in Israel, because so many people came at one time who had barely survived the war?
Yes, the Holocaust is, of course, a turning point in the Jewish history. For me, it is our great failure. And, of course, everyone draw a different conclusion from the Holocaust. There are those who are becoming liberals and, I would say, fighter for human rights because of the Holocaust. There are who are becoming fascists because of the Holocaust, saying, you see what they have done to the Jews, so we have to be strong and we don't have to care about someone else and we have to be egoistic and things like that. And there are those who are drawing the opposite conclusions. There can be many, many different conclusions that can draw from the Holocaust. For me, the Holocaust is, first of all, the great failure of the Jewish people, meaning that our history, we did not take care of ourselves. We did not knew how to lead well our history, and we had pushed ourselves to a corner in which such dreadful things have been done to us.
You know, some Jews are so offended when people blame the Jews for the Holocaust. I'm not blaming them for the Holocaust, but you're saying that it was somehow the
our
fault of the Jewish people.
I mean the fault that we have existed in the diaspora, when there were so many signs all over the way that this kind of life will lead us to catastrophe. Antisemitism did not start with Hitler. Antisemitism was already in the second century before Jesus Christ in Alexandria, when there was there 1 million Jews. The diaspora existence is a problematic existence by itself. This is the reason why Herzl was saying we have to normalize ourselves. The fact that the Jews had continually decided to stay in abnormal situation like the diaspora led them to the Holocaust. And my question is, why at all the diaspora, why at all the Jews had chosen such a way of life that they knew very well that this is disastrous for them.
So you think that all Jews should go to Israel to live?
I think that the Jewish people have to normalize itself in, let's say, having a territory of its own, like the other people in the world, living among themselves. And this is what we call normalization. What is good for the Dutch, what is good for the Danish, what is good for the American, what is good for the Mexican is also good for the Jews. And if the Jews want to behave differently, they have to know that this will not help them.
But in a way, you know, you're talking in support of what I find a very disturbing trend, which is, you know, like Germany for the Germans. Lithuania for the Lithuanians. You know, I mean, the opposite side of the coin that you're describing is of a kind of ethnic or religious chauvinism. I mean, when we look around the world now, we're seeing all this infighting between different ethnic groups and religious groups where each territory wants only their people within it or wants to give the people who are from that territory special rights over other people who have arrived more recently.
I don't see it like this. I see that I don't see any fighting between Denmark and Sweden and Norway, and each country has its own people and its own identity. And what I see in Russia of the Soviet Union today, on the contrary, it's a positive thing that every people is living among himself. You don't have to fight for this. Why the Ukrainian have to fight the Russian and the Russian has to fight the Belarusia or whatever, Latvia and Lita. This was done because they were, I would say, forced to be mingled together. And what they want is that everyone wants to be at home.
Yeah, I know a lot of Palestinians would say that the solution of a Jewish state found a home for the Jews but displaced Palestinians who had been living there. So, I mean, as somebody in the peace movement, how do you reconcile that aspect of the Jewish homeland?
The Jewish homeland, there will be a Jewish homeland and a Palestinian homeland. There will be two homelands. There is enough room to cut this land into two parts. This was the decision of the United Nations in 1947 when it was creating the State of Israel. It was creating not only the State of Israel but the State of Palestine. So there were two states, and this is the only solution that can be held and this is the only just solution for this area. Two people reclaim the same territory. The solution is to cut it into two parts. And why not?
To understand the conflicts today in Israel, you've gone back, especially in your new novel, and written about the history of Israel. What gives you a sense from history that a two-state solution would work for Israel, that Israel and a Palestinian state could coexist side by side?
I don't know. It was not tried, but I would say there is no other solution because we cannot dominate them, and they cannot dominate us, and we cannot now create a new South Africa. The last regime of apartheid is now dismantled. It's a very, very important news for all the peace lover in the world. So what do you want, that we will keep 2 million Palestinians without civil rights for eternity, or they will do it for us? There is no solution. Every people have to dominate himself. This is the rule all over the world. So if they cannot do it, they will be kicked out if they cannot coexist with us. But they will have to do it. And I think that now, after all their fantasies and their illusions, now they came to the point, after so much suffering, that this is the only solution for them. And of course, we can do it. Why not? You believe in the dismantling of the Soviet Union, for example. If I would say to you 6 or 7 years ago that the Soviet Union will be dismantled in 5 years, and afterwards this will be separate states and the Communist Party will be out of order in the Soviet Union, you say, it is impossible. But it is impossible. And I would say to you that the reunification of Germany can be done in 1 year and a half. You would say it is impossible. You see, it is possible. And that the South Africa apartheid will be dismantled by a referendum, and it was done. So why the Palestinians and the Israeli cannot live together? And the Egyptians and the Israelis can live together. We have a peace. I was giving a lecture just 3 weeks ago in Cairo, and I can go by my car to Cairo. So this, we have been enemies. We fought once against the other, but now we are in peace. So why not? Why don't believe in such a things?
I have a writing question for you. A lot of writers and readers in the United States think that the novel has been in something of a crisis, in part because many writers have lost that sense of subject, of a big, important subject to write about. As an Israeli novelist, your country and its dilemmas, what you've described as the soul of your country, is a constant source of material for you. Do you feel blessed in a way as a writer to have this kind of ongoing and complicated and emotional relationship with your country that gives you a constant source of complicated emotional material?
Yes, I'm blessed as a writer, you are right, but I'm cursed as a citizen because I'm not only a writer, I have my children in the army and I'm worried. And I say from time to time, I give up my pleasure as a writer to be more calm and more secure as a citizen. So you are right. You are right by saying, and this is the reason why, in a certain way, the Israeli writing have been a little bit exposed to outside world. Our works are not only translated in America, of course, they are translated in 12 or 14 languages and countries. And we enjoy the fact that we are more... Not only us, I can speak also about the South American writers in a certain way, now about East European countries. You are like the French, you have good life. I don't know, even in America you have problems. But let's take the Scandinavian writers. When I see them, I always see that they are bored in a certain way. Okay, but you know, as a Jew, I'm not afraid of having a dull life. Jews will always find a way to be excited. If it will not be a war, they will find another issue to be excited. So this is our nature, to be in conflict and to be in excitement.
Well, A.B. Yehoshua, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
A.B. Yehoshua's new novel is Mr. Manny. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. Senator Warren Redman, Republican of New Hampshire, has decided not to continue in the United States Senate. He will not run again. He's the inventor of the Graham-Rudman budget balancing law. We also have a report from Cheryl Duvall, who has traveled home with one of the members of Congress who had a few unsubstantiated checks written on the House bank and is trying to explain all that to his voters back home. How much the middle class is mentioned in this campaign versus how much the poor is another subject that we're on tonight. That's a story from Brian Naylor.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Nan Robertson was already a star reporter for the New York Times when she began working in the Washington Bureau in 1963. Covering her first speech at the National Press Club, she encountered one of the most shocking symbols of sex discrimination in journalism. The all-male press club had a tiny balcony where women correspondents were forced to stand, squeezed together, while male reporters and their guests lunched in luxury below. Robertson says that balcony was a metaphor for what working women faced everywhere. Her new book, The Girls in the Balcony, tells the story of how women at the New York Times struggled to attain equal footing with their male colleagues. Maureen Corrigan has a review.
I finished reading The Girls in the Balcony the same day I finally read last week's issue of The New Republic. That's the one with cover stories on the new feminists. Inside, essayist Karen Lehrman discusses why most women today don't call themselves feminists, even though they endorse the movement's basic goals. She doesn't buy Susan Faludi's theory that a concerted backlash is responsible for making feminism unpopular. Instead, she says that feminism itself is the problem. It's too insistent that women view themselves as an oppressed group. Lehrman wants a return to something called heterodoxy, an early 20th century movement that rejected the cramping classification of woman and urged that women just be human beings. Well, like I said, I read Lehrman's piece after I finished Nan Robertson's book, and I kept imagining Robertson shaking her head wearily at Lehrman's vision of a gender-blind society. You see, Robertson chronicles the history of sexism at the New York Times. Many of the women she interviews once thought of themselves in asexual, professional terms. They were reporters, editors, and accountants. But to their surprise, they learned that their employer, the New York Times, thought of them all as women. As health writer Jane Brody testified, that meant they got pats on the fanny instead of raises or promotions. Karen Lehrman would probably dismiss The Girls in the Balcony as a reactionary tale about women reinforcing their own sense of victimization. But I think it's a thrilling story. It's not so much a book about the New York Times as it is about working women coming to respect their own value. And it's a must-read for anyone who's ever ended a sentence with the words, "But I'm not a feminist." Robertson shows why women still need feminism, flawed as it may be. The scary central drama of Robertson's book unfolds in the early 70s, when some Times employees covered and became transformed by the growing women's movement. Activists like then-copy editor Betsy Wade and economics reporter Eileen Shanahan formed a women's caucus, and they discovered, among other horrifying things, that the average salary of a male Times reporter was $59 a week higher than the average woman's salary. In 1974, seven women employees filed a class-action sex discrimination lawsuit against the Times. It dragged on for 4 years until it was settled at the 11th hour out of court. At the end of The Girls in the Balcony, Robertson totes up the gains and losses of the lawsuit. The seven women plaintiffs paid for their courage with stalled careers. But lots more women were hired because of the lawsuit. Writers like Anna Quinlan and Maureen Dowd, and the first female assistant managing editor, Carolyn Lee. But Robertson also recalls a conversation she had with a new female reporter hired 2 years after the lawsuit was settled. This reporter, obviously a believer in heterodoxy, said, "I got here on my own merits, and I'm going to get ahead on my own merits." It must have taken every ounce of self-control Robertson had to stop herself from uttering that old Hemingway line, "Isn't it pretty to think so?"
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Joan Tuohy and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, meet John Doe. John Doe of the punk rock band X, which has reunited. John Doe now also has a solo career and an acting career. He stars in the new film Roadside Prophets. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
The low about 25 to near 30 degrees. Tomorrow, Wednesday, mostly sunny. The high, 55 degrees. Currently, it's clear and 38 in Center City.